That's Levi Parham and them Tulsa Boys and Girls, leading us off for this hour, November 11th, Veterans Day 2018. Coming up, we have music and stories about the war 100 years ago, the wars we've had since then, and about the men and women who have been willing to fight in them. So just ring that bell, I'll come running out. I will come out swinging like a heavyweight. Ring that bell, I'll come running out. I will come out swinging like a heavyweight. All right, baby.
Chances, I'm gonna be your champion, you know. Heavyweight title, honey, is in my name. Just to ring that bell, I'll come running out. I will come out swinging like a heavyweight. Ring that bell, I'll come running out. I will come out swinging like a heavyweight.
All right, baby. Swinging like a heavyweight. Baby, ring that bell, I'll come running out. I will come out swinging like a heavyweight. All right now. I'll be defending you.
Ring that bell and raise the flag. Veterans Day is one of only 10 federal holidays. The banks are closed and government offices, but it's one of only 2 federal holidays that doesn't close the stock market. Columbus Day is the other one that most of us are likely to ignore. I mean, if you don't even get a 3-day weekend out of it, what kind of holiday you call that? There are over 20 million American veterans of the armed services alive today, and as we only get 10 federal holidays all year long, seems like we ought to make some good use of each of them, at least to stop and think about the veterans we've known and the history they've lived through. We start this hour of Stay Human with this meditation from Jeff Weintraub.
My father was 18 in 1942, the year he graduated from high school and went to war. His entry in his high school yearbook features his future plans to get my hands on A. Schickelgruber, which for years was understood to be Hitler's real name until it was later determined that Hitler, in fact, was always Hitler. So from the Bronx to Great Britain with the Third Army and across France in an artillery battery went the highly motivated member of the class of 42, with stops for basic training in the Deep South that left my father with a lifelong hatred of country music and a grudging but unwavering respect for the melting pot. Like many, I suppose, he never talked about combat or really any part of his war experience, save for one incident he mentioned when someone asked him whether he was ever scared during the war. Yes, he said, many times. The story he chose to tell, however, occurred when combat had all but ended, when a German civilian reported to the command of the American occupying forces that she had been raped by a GI in my father's battery. The battery was mustered for inspection, and officers led the civilian slowly through the ranks to identify her assailant. My father recalled her deliberate walk up one line and down another, and especially the unremote possibility of misidentification, with a court-martial and a firing squad hanging in the balance. It was, he said, as frightening a moment as any he encountered throughout his tour of duty. He did not recall whether the German civilian identified anyone, just the fear that having survived everything else, a possibility still remained he might not get to go home. But he soon did, though for an operation that ultimately left him sightless in his right eye. He was nevertheless slated to join the expeditionary force following his convalescence that was being readied for the invasion of the Japanese homeland, where, as we know, casualties were expected to be very, very high. As we also know, Truman decided instead to drop the bomb and spared the troops, and 4 years later, I was born. I've gotten quite a headache trying to reconcile my existence and my son's existence with that decision to exterminate innocent men, women, and children on the other side of the planet so that others might live. For these and other reasons, I always feel somewhat ambivalent on Veterans Day. I never served, nor do I know many who did. Not ambivalence exactly, it is, after all, a day for the rest of us to remember and honor those who did serve, but it is a day that underscores my spectator status. I've never had to confront the question of the ultimate sacrifice, never had to face a decision to risk my life for my country. But that's the goal of civilization, isn't it? To strive to keep its people safe and free from terrors. Many people of my generation have had, in any event, a peculiar relationship with all things military. While our fathers and our mothers lived their salad days inside a great mission that defined them throughout their lives, our war, Vietnam, was the first conflict subject to mass public opposition, even open resistance, that ended not in victory, but exhaustion. We conflated our disdain for the war and the powers that led and kept us there with condemnation of the soldiers who were fighting. Insofar as we remained then and continue to remain safe and aloof while others in essence did and continue to do the dirty work, the price has been a societal fissure that's come to symbolize all the things we've come to believe divide us. I've been to Gettysburg with its places of terrible sacrifice such as Devil's Den and Cemetery Ridge, sites of a vicious crossfire and a desperate charge, hard by the storied cemetery that Lincoln famously consecrated in the name of higher purpose, and felt the weight of history. But last month, my wife and son and I took a vacation in France, and I, for one, was not prepared for the emotional impact of the Normandy beaches. Standing on the vastness of Omaha Beach, for example, with only the sky for cover, and in the clear sight of bluffs from which hell rained down, the notion of fighting and dying for your country lost some of its theoretical character. The American cemetery above Omaha Beach is on a beautiful plot of land donated by France, an immaculate emerald expanse lined with native trees. The 9,000 grave markers are laid out with such precision that every single perspective yields a view of an unbroken line, no one grave standing out, an absolute equality of honor and purpose. The neighboring museum leans heavily on biography to tell the story of Operation Overlord by leading with portraits of the all too brief lives of some of those who perished. Acts of heroism perhaps known only to a few, careers that were interrupted or future plans that were never realized, or the families who have endured their absence or just their names. We left that day most mindful not of the grandeur of the ambition and the remarkable military accomplishment of the landing itself, but rather of the atomic level of war, the individual soldier on the knife edge. My father lost a favorite cousin on D-Day, an airman missing in action. When The Longest Day was released in 1962, the war movie to end all war movies, 3 hours, the invasion soup to nuts, Fonda, Mitchum, and John Wayne leading an army that emptied the 20th Century Fox lots, my father, of course, went to see it, and see it again. And again, and again. Just about every night during its local run, more than 10 times, I think. As actual footage from the invasion was mixed into the recreation, he had hoped to catch a glimpse of his cousin he lost 18 years ago on that longest day. Today, of course, you could pop in a DVD and save your money and your time. But I don't think he cared about either money or time. Rather, I think the movie presented an opportunity to sit alone in the dark with memories he could not share. He did say once that the war was the great adventure of his lifetime, and that nothing else ever quite measured up.
Jeff Weintraub is a frequent contributor to Stay Human. Here's a new song from Gregory Alan Isakov called Bullet Holes.
Withered and blown, like we all do, soon enough. Cover me up with your love. Scratches from the branches, took our chances, sure enough. I am brambled, but I am tangled in your love. All have started it wrong. All have started it wrong. Silver and gold, precious stones, so I'm told. Ah, we're clutching. There ain't nothing we can hold. Pull-ups, pull-ups, all hands up, hit it home. Pull-ups, pull-ups, all hands up, hit it home.
You're tuned to your Northern Community Radio Service, KAXE-KBXE. It's Veterans Day. My bank put a sign in the window last week saying they'd be closed tomorrow, Monday, but they spelled it wrong. I mean, this is a national bank. Well, branch gets the signs in the mail from the home office, and hey, I know nobody likes to be scolded about grammar, but it actually means something. Their sign says, VETERAN'S, Veterans Day, making it the day that belongs to veterans. That's not how it's spelled, because that's not what it is. It's not a day that belongs to veterans or for veterans. In fact, a lot of veterans would rather just leave it alone. It's a day for the rest of us, civilians, whether or not we were ever in the military, living in a country that's been at war in every generation for the past 100 years. Right now, the U.S. population has the lowest percentage of living veterans that it's had in a long time, which makes it easier not to think about or to connect to our own lives or the lives of the veterans among us. And that's another thing besides the apostrophe that I bet my bank doesn't get. Veterans Day is about the living. We have Memorial Day, established after the Civil War to memorialize the war dead. Veterans Day was established to acknowledge the returning American troops who fought the war to end all wars. than ever guessed we'd still needed 100 years later. Here's one living veteran, Marine First Lieutenant Ernesto Rodriguez, a citizen born in Puerto Rico, talking to his son for StoryCorps.
First Lieutenant Ernesto Rodriguez is a father of two. He deployed to Iraq in 2005 when he was a new dad. When he returned, he struggled to keep his life together, but never spoke about those times with his 11-year-old son, Sebastian, until this interview.
What was it like to go to war in Iraq?
I would look forward to be sent over there because that's the Marine in me. But then I could be killed. There is a possibility of me not seeing you guys ever.
Did you think about us while you were over there?
Every day. When I left, you were just starting to crawl. And then when I came back, you were already walking and you didn't know me. You were completely terrified. And it was the most difficult part of coming back.
Has war changed you?
That's another very difficult question. I was hoping to talk about the things with you when you grow up. But yes, war does change you. There was an Iraqi kid about your age, and he was dead. And it could have been you. That kind of thing changes you as a person.
Why did you have to move into the homeless shelter?
When I came back, your mom and I, we went through a divorce, and I didn't have anywhere to live anymore. How did that make you guys feel?
I was a little scared for you. Sometimes I wouldn't know where you were, and I was scared before I went to bed.
It's okay, Pa. It's all right.
It wasn't good, but now in the apartment you have, when we like go to see you, I feel safer and I feel that you are safe. And I feel like you're a dad because...
So what does that mean? Okay. What is to be a dad mean? This is very interesting.
In school, there's like some thing on like what makes a dad.
Like a picture on the wall?
It's a writing. And It says, God took calmness of a mountain, the warmness of a sun, and a tons of other stuff, and put it into one together and call it a dad. You're just like everything that I would possibly need.
Just know that I love you, and that everything that I had done is because of you. To see you every day, to answer your questions about life, just like we're doing right now, that is to me the most important thing.
He in the airport with his family, dressed in all fatigue. They calling his flight number on their intercom because they're about to leave. So he goes to his wife, hugs her, hugs his daughter as she grieves. She don't want him to go. She said, Daddy, please don't go, please. He's bent down over to her, squatted, and said, listen, honey, it'll be okay. She said, yeah, but that's not what all the kids in my school say. They say you're gonna get shot. They say you're gonna die. Why would you wanna leave us, Daddy? Why? Why? He said, I will never leave you. That's a fact. And what those kids at school are telling you, don't listen to them. It's all whack. I'm gonna write to you every single day, matter of fact. And I want you to write back, okay? Make sure you write back. He made her feel better. He got on his flight, waved goodbye, thought about her all night. Gotta go to war tomorrow, is what he thought in his head. That person was me. And I'm so glad I'm not dead.
That poem, Veteran, from Lil Fraser. And before that, Ernesto and Sebastian Rodriguez on StoryCorps. Most American veterans living today served in the Persian Gulf and Afghanistan, slightly more than the still among us Vietnam vets. The war in Afghanistan has now lasted 17 years, and nobody, not one of your senators or your generals or enlisted men or women, nobody can say how we'd even know if we won that war, 17 years and counting. And as far as I can make out, the U.S. plans to still be at war in Afghanistan a year from now, when some 18-year-old recruit can be deployed in a war that started before they were born. Spending billions of dollars, our tax dollars, every year to fight it, and there's nearly 15,000 active duty personnel there now. Personnel is a nice impersonal word, isn't it? And as wars go, 15,000 might not sound like a big number, but every one of them is somebody's son or daughter, brother, sister. Every one of them is somebody. You know, you have to take the apostrophe out of Veterans Day, but you can't take out the catastrophe. Every generation for 100 years includes veterans that come back, but not all the way back. It wasn't until 1981 that post-traumatic stress disorder was officially recognized as a service-related disability. Around the country this weekend, hotlines and drop-in centers and support services geared to veterans have all staffed up, prepared for the annual spike of people in crisis triggered by Veterans Day. Americans overwhelmingly support more federal spending for veterans' services and benefits, like 75% in a recent Pew Research poll. I didn't hear anything about that during the recent election season, or about the national defense budget either, $716 billion for 2019. I have no idea what $716 billion of anything is, but it's coming from somewhere, and truthfully, it doesn't make me feel all that safe. I'm Michael Goldberg, and you're listening to the Veterans Day edition of Stay Human.
He sat cross-legged on the sidewalk. A far-off look was in his eyes, in his hands. Held a piece of cardboard as everyone walked by. The sign read USMC veteran. I'm not myself, please pray for me. So I stopped and said, you fought to save my freedom. What can I do? What do you need? He said, I'd like to shower off these painful memories, get a shave and a pair of new jeans, a meal I don't have to eat alone, find a place to let my guard down, a real bed instead of hard ground, maybe an address and a phone. I know I've made it bad, but I'm not home. He said, I saw a mortar take my best friend. In an instant he was gone. I don't sleep, I bawl my eyes out in the middle of the night. Can't let it go, I can't move on. Wish I could shower off these painful memories, get a shave and a pair of new jeans, a meal I don't have to eat alone, find a place to let my guard down, a real bed instead of hard ground, maybe dress and a phone. I know I've made it bad, but I'm not home.
shower off these painful memories. Get a shave and a pair of new jeans. Find a way to clear these minefields from my mind. Recognize the face in the mirror. See the man who used to be there. I may be down, but I've got hope. I know I've made it back, but I'm not. An army mechanic. I worked with the men. I worked on my back. I tried to fit in. Torque wrenches and ratchets, multimeters and scales. Grease on my face, grease on my hands, grease under my nails. And it was so hard to see till it attacked with my enemy. Wasn't Iraq. Soldiers bartered and traded. That's the way our world worked. Trading favors for favors in the sand and the dirt. But I wouldn't give them. They tried to take. To the sky, ask the Lord why I have
Mary Gaucher, one of her veteran songs, Iraq. And before that, I'm Not Home, written by Laura McCall Torno and sung by Matt Dame. Coming up later in this hour, we'll hear from history professor Brian Vroman about the Great War and the armistice of November 11, 1918. But first, we have this from my friend Sarah Baker about Veterans Day 1960.
I'd like to start with talking about holidays in general. They were celebrated in my family, and I was really fortunate to grow up in an environment where children got to hang out with adults, and we were treated as one with them. And so lots of stories, lots of food, family from town would come over. And what I remember most about Veterans Day was that it was different, obviously, than Christmas or 4th of July. And it was a day, Mom always called it a day of remembrance. So I think I was about 10 when it really made sense to me. I do remember Walter Cronkite in our living room talking about Veterans Day activities all across the nation, and so I think that helped me, like, oh yeah, it's happening everywhere, I get it now. And my father would share his stories of being in the Army throughout the year, but especially on Veterans Day, I think just talking about his experience, his brothers, my uncle on my mom's side, my great uncle, and their stories varied, of course, what my brother and I expected would be more like the TV show Combat that we watched. Dad's stories were filled with where he was stationed and what he was doing there. He was an Army machinist, so he wasn't on the front lines of combat, but he did talk about being in the hospital in London during the air raids, and often you know, everybody in the hospital had to go and be undercover for a while and then return. And I think what really hits me, especially thinking back about this now, is there was probably very little communication about what happened, how many people were killed. You know, it was dark. They would have lights out. And it sounded, when he talked about it, like a very fearful situation. You just didn't know. And especially being vulnerable, sitting in the hospital like he was. I did notice that my great uncle, for example, who had been in World War I, did not share any stories. It was very obvious, and he was quite a storyteller himself. But when it came to anything about World War I, Uncle Vernon would walk away. And I asked my mom about that, and that's when I learned of the word shell shock, which, you know, when you're a kid, you think of shock, you understand that, but the shell, and I was thinking, is that the casing on the gun? How did that affect him where he can't talk about it? Well, then later I learned, obviously, it was the PTSD, his trauma, and didn't feel the warm fuzzies of sharing any of it with us. Just really seemed like he wanted to keep that separate from his life. When I think of the shell shock piece, I remember how quiet my mom was as my dad would talk about it. And one of the things she shared with me was in the evening, she was living with her mom while my dad was overseas, a fresh young bride. And she said in the evening they'd be on the porch sipping their last cup of coffee of the day and visiting. And she said they would see in the distance the Western Union man coming on his bicycle. And they would literally stop talking and didn't resume talking until he had passed by their house, because that's how they received news of someone being killed. And so it hit me hearing that story of my mother's situation with a husband there. Her brother was in India, northern India. My dad was in the Europe front. And that the folks back home were really doing everything they could. You know, she talked a lot about the rations and not having nylons and you know, all of the work people did to help bring those guys back home, but also that fear is, are they returning home? And so I think it just brought about a lot of discussion in my family about war. And, you know, later as I grew and started reading about nonviolent interventions and Martin Luther King and Gandhi and just thinking, you know, how did we get in that pickle? But I think my father and my mother both realized or said, you know, we did what we had to do. That was the message. We were celebrating, I guess, you know, we weren't at war at that time. And to think that, yes, we're at peace. And it almost always seemed as though we won't have to do this again.
Do you know any veterans of the current wars, veterans of the Gulf Wars?
I do. I taught for 20 years adjunct faculty at Bemidji State University, and I would say the last 5 or 6 years, there were more men in social work, it felt like. I had more male students, and several from Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of them actually started a Wounded Warriors project that takes guys fishing, people fishing, and many activities, just, you know, like getting together so that there's a safe place for them to talk. But we all might wonder, gosh, what did you experience? And I think the important piece is that they experienced a huge shift in their life, and they did put themselves in harm's way.
Thanks to Sarah Baker of Bemidji for sharing that on Stay Human. Sarah's a very wise person, I think, and she has the answer to my question about Veterans Day. The question was, how could we make some good use of observing this holiday? Maybe by talking to someone. If you're a vet, to your children and grandchildren. If someone you love is a veteran, to let them talk if they want to. It's easy to just ride on reflex. Thank you for your service. Reflex is not the same as respect. After 4 years of unimaginable human carnage, a scale never before seen in all of human history, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, the guns across Europe finally fell silent with the stroke of a pen in Paris. At the beginning of that war, my grandfather was a draft dodger. Tsar Nicholas would have drafted him into the Imperial Army and sent him straight to the Eastern Front to face the Germans, cannon fodder like all the Jewish boys. But Grandpa Sam wasn't having it. He hid under a hay wagon to get across the border and eventually made his way to a new life in the USA and got drafted, not 2 years later, as a private in the US Army, shipped back across the Atlantic to the Western Front. I don't know what he thought about that at the time, but he went and he fought, and I'm pretty sure he was glad, always cautious, always expecting the worst, but still glad to be an American. I know for sure he kept his Army-issued DOP kit for the next 50 years.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me, every son of liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, go today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud her boy's in line. Over there, over there, send the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the
ends are coming, the drum coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the words, who beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over there.
I spoke this week with my friend Brian Vroman, but not about his military service. Brian teaches history at Itasca Community College, and I wanted to ask him, after President Wilson had gotten reelected in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war," what was it like on the home front when America joined the war in 1917?
There was war fever. There was also some opposition to the war. When World War II happened, there's very little opposition to the war. Even then, there's some, but very, very little. But there were segments of the population that were opposed to the war. There were some socialists who opposed the war. There were people who were members of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies, that opposed the war. And there were some pacifists. So there are people from various backgrounds who opposed the war. They were a minority, but there were significant numbers of them, and some were vocal. Some went to jail. Others were tarred and feathered in acts of mob violence. But yes, many went to jail for essentially standing up for their beliefs, following their conscience. There was significant anti-German sentiment. It's interesting. There were, of course, lots of Americans of German ancestry, and the Kaiser actually did expect them to come back to Germany and join the army, the German army. Obviously, almost none did, and of course, many German Americans enlisted or were drafted in the United States Army and fought, but there was anti-German sentiment, and this was expressed in sometimes silly ways. For example, sauerkraut, staple food in many rural parts of America. But sauerkraut is a German word, so people take to calling it liberty cabbage, reminiscent of the freedom fries after 9/11, if you can remember that. There was an organization, a state organization, part of the state government, I believe it's called the Committee for Public Safety or the Commission of Public Safety. I don't recall offhand, but their job was to essentially look for people who are not loyal. And if anybody expressed, I guess, their Germanness with too much vigor, they were suspect. To my recollection, there was a law that was passed outlawing the use of German, or the German language, in Minnesota. And, you know, there were no traitors in Minnesota, but in this period of hysteria, even speaking against the war, if you thought it was a bad idea, if you thought it wasn't being conducted properly, that was enough to get you labeled as a traitor. So I want to put this in a very broad context. So we can go back to the 18th century and the Enlightenment era. The Enlightenment era is the most optimistic era in human history. There's nothing even close to it. And even though we think of the Enlightenment as an 18th century movement, it still impacts the 19th century. People like Karl Marx, for example, he thought of himself as a child of the Enlightenment. You can think of science and the increasing advancement of science. The advancement of human learning and unleashing human learning to solve human problems. The progressive era kind of fits in with that too. The period before World War I retains this incredible optimism, and that optimism is shattered in the trenches of Europe. This has been overstated maybe by scholars, but it's basically true. And you can see this reflected if you look at the art and the literature of the time. What was this war for? When you stand back and look at it, all these millions of men dying, it's absurd. Well, look at Kafka and absurdism in literature. Look at absurdism in art. This is all a product of World War I. And optimism takes a big hit. America retreats. We're not going to transform the world. We're going to retreat from the world. So pessimism becomes the norm. One of the real tragedies of World War I is that it resolved nothing. It resolved nothing. It just set the stage for another even bigger war. Nothing was solved in that war. And a lot of forces were unleashed. Think of this. The Tsar is gone. The Romanov family is gone. The Habsburg Empire is gone. The Ottoman Empire is gone. And now what happens to all these people that were once subject people? Well, Wilson believed in self-determination. What happens in the Middle East? The Ottoman Empire is gone, and what happens there is the UN, the League of Nations, gives the British a mandate, and they redraw the maps. But now we have artificial countries like Iraq that consists of Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, and Kurds. Not a natural country at all. And we know from recent history what that ultimately meant. So again, nothing's resolved. And the hatred between the Germans and the French, for example, has just increased exponentially. And Hitler and people like him are going to want revenge.
Thanks to Brian Vroman of Itasca Community College. He's a frequent contributor to Stay Human, helping us understand where we've been.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end to war.
Buffy St. Marie on Northern Community Radio, KAXE, KBXE. I'm the volunteer producer of this program, heard every week at this hour. My thanks to Brian Vroman, Sarah Baker, and Jeff Weintraub for being part of this week's Veterans Day show. Thanks also to the voters of Minnesota for enacting the Legacy Funds Amendment, including the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which contributes to this and other local programs. This program is called Stay Human, with respect for veterans and civilians too. We'll close out the program with David Byrne in live performance with a chamber orchestra.
Lived in a brownstone, I lived in a ghetto, I lived all over. receiver, hope of an answer someday. I got three passports, a couple of visas. Well, you don't even know my real name. On a hillside, the trucks are loaded, everything's ready to roll. I sleep in the daytime, I work in the nighttime. I might not ever get home. Say no party, this ain't no disco, this ain't no fooling around. I'm at the point club for CBGB.
Postcard.